I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker for the month of June. I'm getting good. He will be speaking on 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th, and this is Greg.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Greg. I'd like to thank Greg for speaking. You know, he said one little thing that reminded me of something, and you said alcohol made us do silly, dangerous, and even criminal things. And I was trying to paint a picture over these last couple of weeks that I did those things without alcohol. You know what I mean? So where's the fault lie, you know? In keeping with the format, I know the program, if done in a sequence, is designed to bring about a conclusion. You know, that much I can tell you. You know, I'm no guru here, but Einstein can, you know, I don't have to be an Einstein to figure that out. Something's going to happen when I do these things. I remember the point now, I did the fourth step, I did the fifth step. I don't feel oneness with my fellows. I mean, I feel a part of, I'm not that closer to God. I mean, I'm a little bit closer because I did things I wouldn't normally do. The reading, the writing, the praying, I did those things. The old ideas are starting to get cast aside. And one thing I remember when I looked at step six, to have these things removed and stuff, and I says, I really don't have to work too hard on this one because I have a 10-step. You know, when I'm wrong, I'll admit it, you know, but I can keep on doing, this is my thought process, I'll keep on doing the same things, and later on I'll take care of them, you know. And in preparation, again, in doing my fourth step, I got a whole bunch of pamphlets. You know, from this group, from that group, from Hazleton, from this place and that place, NA. And I said this last week. So I really got confused with a lot of things. And the one thing I remember in the Hazleton guide was the 6 and 7 steps are the forgotten steps. And that stuck with me. You know? And if you look in our program that's written in our book, it's only 2 short paragraphs. It's only 2 short paragraphs. So it's easy, like I said, with a mindset like I got. And, you know, we're looking at these things, and you think you're coming out of you're getting an awakening, and all I'm doing is I'm coming out of delusion. You know, that's all. I'm like moving into denial. You know what I mean? And if you look up the word delusional, like, and I had to look up a lot of words, and I was fortunate enough that somebody would, and we had a college student, and he said, buy yourself a dictionary. So I bought myself a dictionary, and I just want to read some of these things. As we talk about in the earlier chapters, it gives the words illusion, delusion, the insanity, and all that other stuff. And it says the illusion and delusion go together, you know. An illusion is a false impression based on wishful thinking. And how many times have I, you know, wishful thinking, this is going to get better, it ain't that bad, and all that stuff. And then you go to delusion. It refers to a false belief held without reservation as a result of self-deception. And that's what I've been doing all my life. You know, lying to myself, believing a lie and lying to myself. And believing what I was doing was nothing wrong with what I was doing. There was nothing wrong at all. And I went a little further because I know dictionaries are different. And so I'll give you another definition for illusion. Something that deceives the eye or the mind. In my case, it was my mind. Something that deceives me, kept deceiving me. A mistaken perception or belief. And delusion, a false belief, a persistent and false mental conception of the facts as they really are. Although, you know, self-deception, the act of misleading. And the stronger of all those I just gave is delusion, because it's usually associated with harm. The harm I'm doing to myself and believing that I'm not doing any harm to anybody else. No, I'm not, just not. So now I'm on the 6th step, I'm looking at these things, and I'm out of delusion. Yeah. I can delude myself even to this day if I get into myself. And what I've learned, too, looking at this, I can live with a lot of stuff. I lived all my life with a lot of guilt, remorse, you put any name you want on it. You know, the harms I've done to other people. You talked about being one to be someplace else. You know, that restlessness, that irritability, and discontentment, unhappiness, and just looking at all these things. I got all right with this. You know, I got cold, I got calloused, I wore off people. I got all right with this. The false belief that nobody knows anything. I knew so much when I came here that wasn't true. I had a hard time learning anything else new. And when we look at this, I'm going to read it from here. It says, are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Now, if you look back preparing for this, alcoholic self-centered in his extreme, you know, all his problems of his own making, though he usually doesn't think so, I was still there. Though he usually doesn't think so. Even though I had the written form in front of me, the fourth and the fifth step, and I shared these with another guy, I still was not out of blame. You know, my mind could say, yeah, but. You can always tell an alcoholic when he walks in the room, he goes, yeah, but. Then he'll say, you don't understand. I'm different. And sometimes I'll use it in this whole sentence. Yeah, but you don't understand, I'm different. You know what I mean? So I had to really, I mean, right off the bat, you see some things that are objectionable. You really do. Because you know they're against the law, they're unwillful, they're against my beliefs. You know right away, there's no getting over the fact. You know some of those things. Now, again, I told you I had a big problem. Raised Catholic, I had a big problem with God here. I had big resentment of him. You know, I didn't even know what resentment was. I was really angry at him because he didn't do the things I wanted to do. I was under the bridge because of him, and I was, all my plights were because of him. Had to be somebody. There was nobody else to blame. There was no parents, no boss. There was nobody around. I had to blame somebody. Might as well be God. Couldn't see him anyway, right? And it's him. It's his fault. So what they're trying to tell me in this sixth step, we get away from blaming, and we get into acceptance. We start to get into acceptance, to accept my life was of my own doing. You know, I mean, every fact that happened to me during my life was not my fault, but in most cases, the silliness, the dangerousness, the criminalness, I put myself in those positions because the rewards of what I was going to do outweighed the consequences. It just didn't matter what trouble I was getting. I got to that point where it didn't matter anymore. So now I'm here. Can God take these things from me? Okay, I'll let him. I'll let him. No problem here. And I'd still be acting the same way. You know, just doing the same stupid things, being confused, being this, and what's happening? I said, come on, they're yours. They're yours. No. Where am I? And something we don't often talk about is the basic instincts of life, which I never knew about until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My basic instincts. You know, what I thought about myself, what I think other people think about me, my ambitions, my goals, my desires. My desires for now, my desires for the future. Anybody messes with my pocketbook, you know what I mean? And financial things. And I didn't know these things. So, again, here I am. I'm still in my first year out of the institution. I'm still working a part-time job. I still don't have a driver's license. I still can't get anything in my name. No credit. But I got something working for me. And the only thing I found out was doing my fifth step was I had the willingness. You know, they pounded this into my head. Greg, you cannot run your own life. You know, you can't do it. Not that you can't. You haven't done it. Let's put it that way. So I'm looking at these things. And I, for a long time, I never see this. I never seen this. If we still cling to something and will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. You know, and I was told I had the willingness, but I also told you I had trouble praying. You know, my set was, if I pray to God, he'll know where I am. You know, he'll know where I am now. I had to change a lot of old ideas. You know, we look at my inventory. We look at the columns. And the greatest thing, and I told you how my inventory was, it was shambles. But I've learned, I started the process. And I've learned how to do it better. I learned how to do it more thorough. I learned how to be more honest. I learned how to be more open. As we go along, more things come to my mind. But it's the same thing I have to keep looking forward to. Looking towards, what am I doing? Why are these things happening? You know, and I found out people and situations will always affect me. Will always affect me. No matter whether I think I got God on my side or not, something will always tick me off. The basic instincts will always be affected in any situation. So now, when I said in the third step, we turn it over in the third step, God don't want my free will. He gave it to me as a gift. He don't want it. He don't even want my alcoholism because he isn't an alcoholic. He doesn't need it. Just go about your business. Have fun. This is your life. You can go left, you can go right. You know, I heard this, one of the new songs by Mick Jagger. This is not pre-conference approved either. Mick Jagger is singing a song. He went to the desert looking for Buddha, and all he found was Jesus. And Jesus just shook his shoulders, lit his cigarette. He says, jump for joy, make some noise, and remember what I said. So I had no concept of what God was teaching us, of what the philosophies like, whether it was Buddha, whether it was Zen, and they're all intermingled. I had no idea of this. You know, and here I am looking. I got to pray. And I don't know, this is the God's honest truth. At that point in the sequence, I didn't know what I was clinging to. Because I didn't want this crap no more. Take them. I don't know what I'm clinging to. And sometimes today, I still suffer from strange mental blank spots. And if anybody gets to know me real well, they'll know. They know I ain't lying. And the thing of this today, the sixth and seventh step, God, I'm willing. I'm ready. But yet, the instincts come. You know, driven, even today, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-centeredness, everything is self, driven by me. I know right from wrong, I know law, I know breaking laws, and I could still do something. Emotions are fleeting, they wear off, and then I have a conscience. So the preparation for this, and you read the 12 and 12, it separates the men from the boys. It's an ongoing process. Two paragraphs in here. That's why I refer everyone that I sponsor. This is how you get the directions in our program that's written in a book. Information passed on from one person to another through the written word. And that's what I try to pass on to my sponsors. But I encourage them to read the 12 and 12 because Bill was more, our founders were more into sobriety, working with others, knowing the human frailties, the human personality, and he elaborates more on that fits us alcoholics. Read these things, enhance it, and it makes a heck of a lot more sense. It's an ongoing process. You know? See, I'm trying to not get ahead of myself because that's next week's stuff. Like, sometimes it just flows. It's just a simple prayer. I'm going to say it at the end of the meeting, right? My Creator? Yeah. I'm now willing you should have all of me, the good and the bad. See, I sat in the rooms of AA for a long time waiting to get good before I was going to do this work. And circumstances made me try something different, you know? The willingness to pain. The pain got great enough. So, God loves me whether I'm good or bad, and I had to get that concept. You know, He loves me whether I'm putting my hand out at the door over here, whether I'm sticking somebody up. He loves me the same. That's a great concept I couldn't get with. You know, that's a great concept. Take me good and bad. And there's a lot of good in me, and there's a lot of bad in me. You know, it depends on who's doing the scorecard. I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character. I had no character back then. I really didn't have a character. So I'm just here. I'm trying to bring myself back there. If you knew or even today, I still went ahead and did this program even though I didn't understand it. Even though I didn't have a loving, caring God. You know, like third step, I got God on my side. And I'm so grateful to these people because I don't know if I'm grateful to them. I want to get out there and I want to shake them. You know, go 1, 2, 3, cha cha cha, you're out the door. You know, I got God now, things are going to be fine. I didn't have that. I didn't have it working for me. And it says here, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Now, if we go back, and I have to look, I was useless at everything. I mean, I drove myself under the ground, I drove myself under the bridge, I drove everybody that loved me away from me. I always said, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. I'll be fine. Boom. Eventually, they left me alone. I didn't know what I was doing, and I wasn't fine. You know? So now, I wasn't useless. I couldn't have relationships with anybody, male, female. I couldn't have friends. My best friend from Little League, my best man at my wedding, I almost killed him with a baseball bat because he borrowed some money, and I wasn't there to give it to him. He stole it from me, in other words. Nobody got that. Okay, I had to elaborate. Right in front of his parents' house. Threatened his wife, too. I said, if I don't get my money back, this house is going to be trashed. You know, I couldn't be useful to anybody. It was all about me. Don't mess with me. Grant me strength. What do we say in the Serenity Prayer? And that was one of the eye-opening things I got. Somebody gave me a Serenity Prayer on a card, the full version of the Serenity Prayer. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as a pathway to peace. And this is the way the card read at the time. Taking, as Jesus did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, and trusting he will make all things right if I surrender to his will. I told you that somebody gave me a third step card when I was still in the institution. So these things are hitting me. And it tells me my usefulness to you and to my fellas. We all got that. I'm sure we do. How can I help anybody? How can I be of service? How can I be of use to anybody? Look at me. How can I do these things? You know, that's the strength I need. Our daily bread consists of what we need for that day, not the food we consume. What we need for the day. Give me this day our daily bread. Give me what I need for the moment. Take away my defects of characters for the moment. They're not going to be removed for a lifetime. And see, I had that concept. Everybody comes in. And we're all well-meaning in AA meetings. You know, just do these things and you carry the defects and then you get the promises on 83 and 84. And you'll totally know everything. We give a wrong conception here, and especially with a sick mind like me. I told you, I'm just getting out of delusion here. I'm still stuck with no wishful thinking. That's why we have sponsors. And if you don't have a sponsor, please get one. And if you don't have a sponsor that's willing and to encourage you to read this book, because the sponsor can't do the work for you, get another sponsor. Don't do this alone. That's my public service message. And it goes on to say our main purpose is to fit ourselves to the people among us. You know, somebody once told me, I'm struggling to get closer to God. I got to get God. You know, I got to get God. You want to get closer to God, get closer to his people. Here's where the work's got to be done. Here's where the work's got to be done. And just go with that concept. Just leave it there. And I told you, I had trouble being, and somebody asked me, you have trouble being alone? I said, only when I'm around people. You know what I mean? Sometimes today, I still do. I got a little card here. Maybe you get a kick out of it, I don't know. This is the accepting steps, 6 and 7, the tools of change. Got this in a tape. Acceptance of the defects of characters and shortcomings that were not removed is very difficult considering my immaturity and my grandiosity. Okay. Now, we talk about 8 and 9. This is funny because it says here, I'm going to read this because I like the way this reads. It says, faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all the persons we have harmed to whom we are willing to make amends. We made the list when we took inventory. I threw mine out. I remember thinking, I even said, Dean, I don't have the list. Remember we threw it out? Write a new one. A little panic there for a short period of time. It says here, we subject ourselves to drastic self-appraisal. And I was as drastic as I could be at that time. And I really wasn't that drastic. It was just the things that were getting me at the time. A lot of old things I left behind in that institution for 13 months, they pounded me. They had to get to me. I told you I was going to get left back. I was going to get discharged because I wasn't participating verbally. I wasn't communicating with them. So when they finally got to me, they got to me. I remember we had this thing, and I don't want to spend too much time on the institution, but I will anyway because I like the way I tell the story. We had what we called a probe. Now, a probe is... We were up at 8 o'clock, normal daily hours, and they decide they're going to pick a certain amount of people. We're going to go to, like, the rooms, like the mafia used to do. We put tape over the windows, we put mattresses on the floor, and we were to stay there until they went through each and every one of us. Counselors, music, you know, they even gave us a break to eat. I don't know how long we were there, but you got to remember, we were up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we went to the next day and the next afternoon. And when you're tired, you have no defense. And you have no defense, and I have to watch that even today. Because I work nights, I have to get my sleep. Looking forward to going into this room, I really was. I'm at a phase where I'm comfortable with myself. I've been in there about 7-8 months. And I said a little prayer, because I lied to the institution when I got in about my past criminal, dangerous, silly things I did just to get in there. I didn't want to get thrown out. And I said, "Dear Lord, please help me to be honest. But don't let me tell this. Don't let me tell that. Don't let me tell this." I was serious. Who do you think they picked on first? Man. Who do you think gave up the things you didn't want to tell? Well, self-drastic. What I was saying is some of the stuff I left behind that weren't really burning at me anymore. The hatred for my family, my mother and father, who I've, through this fellowship, I've grown in tons of understanding. I've come to know and love them in the last couple of years that I had with them. The first 38, 39, even 40 years, this was a driving force. They were the root of my problems. The resentments were just piled up, and they were really silly ones. They were really silly ones. Again, they were unrealistic expectations of what I think they should be doing for me. It's what they should be doing for me. Again, reading the 12 and 12. Now, I had my own little place. The guy I was living with, we had a lease. He moved. He bought a house. I had to get out of the lease, and I don't know if you recall this. I needed a roommate. I couldn't find a roommate. At the time I was dating, I was 13, stepped by one of the women in the fellowship, and don't give me no ahs, because you know you women do that. I don't want to hear that. I tell you how spiritual and good I was trying to be. She said to me, "Eventually we're going to end up in bed." And I said, "What are your motives? What are your motives?" I didn't know what else to say, you know? What do we mean by that? We're going to end up in bed. I'm married to that woman today. So she came up with the idea, I'll move in with her, you know? And this is how drastic, you know? And I'm reading the 12 and 12, I'm looking at these things, and it says, at one point, I couldn't stay there no more. I was getting to the point I had to go. But again, I have nothing in my name. I can't get nothing in my name. So the 12 steps says we should be weaned from our parents long ago. Now the guilt is coming back. I need help. Who do you ask? You ask your parents. And it wasn't much, but I, you know, what do I do? What do I do? I can't stay in this situation. I got to get out on my own for once in my life. I'm not alone. I'm torn between staying, the guilt of leaving, the guilt of asking. And I'm still waiting for Hallmark to put out a card, you know. Guilt, the gift that keeps on giving, you know. So I'm doing all these things, and I'm drastic appraisals, and I shouldn't be this, I shouldn't be that. Do I owe her an amend, you know, all that other stuff. But the first thing is, yeah, I got a drastic appraisal. I got to be willing. I'll come back to this sometime, maybe. I asked, I got the money, I got my own place. I finally got my license back. Peggy gave me her old car, and then more guilt. I left her, she still gave me a car. You know, all that little kid stuff and sensitiveness and am I doing the right thing? Am I just using her? What are my motives? What are my motives? You know, I got my own place, and if anybody remembers, I used to hate to go home as a kid. Now here I am, I'm 39 years old, I got a car, I'm feeling independent. I hated to go into my own house, and there was nobody else there. So there's something underlying. I don't know. It's outer womb, inner child stuff, and I don't really care. You know, it's just the way I was at that time. Do I have trouble being alone? Only when I'm with myself. at this point. So I got to become willing to do the things that I look, the parents, the weaning, and this and that, and this and that, and back and forth. And I said this, and I'll say it again. I was going to a lot of step meetings, and one day the thought occurred to me how I can finally, me and my dad never had conversations. There really wasn't any chemistry bond between us. The only thing there was, he was my dad, I was his son. I finally came up with an idea of what I could say to him. Dad, I'm sorry you were an asshole all your life. And after I heard myself saying this, I said, I know that ain't right. This is supposed to be about me. I'm here to sweep off my side of the street, which has accumulated over my living on my self-will. You know? I prayed again for the willingness. But I still put my forcefulness in it. It says whenever, wherever possible. So I had a wherever possible day where my sister was going to be there, my mother was going to be there, my father was going to be there, and I had this plan. I don't know how many times we rehearsed this and we went over this and we subtracted and we dug back. And everything worked out to plan. I got my mother alone, I got my sister alone, and it wasn't like, can I talk to you? It just worked out. Not one voice, word came out of my mouth. How, again, the guilt and all this stuff, how can I ever repay her putting up with my crap, the 17 months of her not knowing where I was? You know, the deterioration of all that she strived for me. I could say it now. Over-exhausting survey, and I could say it. But the only thing, the conclusion I came to, the only thing I could be is a good son to them. That's all I could be. To do the things I never did as a kid. When she asked me to call, I can call. I can even call when she doesn't ask me to. I can let her know where I am. I could be a good son. I could send her a Christmas card. Not because of this fellowship, I'm 39 years old. I never knew my sister's birthday. I've learned my sister's birthday. I send her cards. I don't forget. I visit her. I call her. I can only be Greggy. You know, all those words and all the things I did want to say, and oh, my family wasn't like that. I wasn't like that at the time. You know, the only thing I've learned to do with my dad was tell him I love him. I've never heard those words. I never told him all the years growing up. The last three years of his life, I was able to tell him I love him every time I was with him, every time I hung up the phone. And not once did he ever say it back. But I knew he did. He just couldn't do it. Just as I couldn't do certain things, he just couldn't do it. You know, you get to talk afterwards with my sister, and my mother was still around, and other friends still that knew. The guy was always proud of me. He was always bragging about me. But I never knew this, you know. The guy, before I started this journey, was a bum. And these are my mother's words. This is where I get the poison from. And then I form my own opinion based on me. You know, he was a bum. And I believed that until I became a bum. Apple don't fall far from the tree, but I ain't blaming my dad. He never forced a drink down my throat. He bought me a drink when I was 21 years old, and with his limited pocketbook, he said, why don't you drink beer? Because I was drinking gin and orange juice. Men don't drink beer. The guy was proud of me. The guy loved me, even though he could never tell me this. And he tried his best. I mean, he had the same affliction that I have. He can even give it up for Lent. I was always amazed by that. And I remember as a kid, I said, Dad, you're going to start drinking on Easter again? Because I remember the destruction. And he said, yeah, 40 days, I don't know. I did my penance. I'm going to start again. So those years are starting to waste away. And I remember the day he was in the hospital. It was the beginning of December. He died on December, I was going to say 7th. I know the date, 17th. I was having trouble with my car. And I was having hemming and hawing because, you know, he was going in and I didn't do what I wanted to do. And one of my big things was I didn't want to sit down and write a letter and stick it in his casket like I've heard other people in the fellowship do. So this thing was driving me in, yet I still, the willingness, I pray for the willingness. You know? But one thing I've learned about prayer is I got to believe I have it. The scientific way of praying is what I ask for, I got to believe I got it and then act accordingly. Act as if I got it. And I do got it. You know? I couldn't make it up. My car was broke. I postponed a couple of days. I started the journey with my car. Got halfway up the parkway. Had to turn around because of the car. Dean offered me his car. Peggy offered me their car. And I kept making excuses and this and that. So the day I decided I was going to go up, I didn't think I was going to take Peggy's car. I woke up about 5:20. And simultaneously the phone rang. It was my mother. My dad had died. So the first thing I did, I sat down and I wrote them the letter, saying the words on paper that I couldn't say to them in front of them. And I did put it in the casket. And there was some healing. You know, there was that, whatever we're striving for, it was all right. Even though it's not what I wanted to do, at that moment it was all right. And it's still all right to this day. It's just, see, I'm the one who, they told me put down the baseball bat. You know, every once in a while I pick up a bag with a sock in it or something, you know, something soft. I leave the bat alone. What I did or what I didn't do, I cannot change, and that's what they tell us in this fellowship. Yesterday's gone. Don't even remember it. Don't even remember it. My mother was a different story. My mother's got a character just like me. She'll, at the flip of a hit, she'll tell you what she thinks. You know, so she was a little bit easier. A little bit easier, you know. Really, I mean, I'm not a communicative guy. I don't talk about my feelings. I didn't talk about my feelings. I didn't know what I was feeling. You know, it was mostly anger, fear. So for me to sit down with my mom, I remember when I was 36 years old, I was still somewhat functional, and my mother was still telling me how to get my hair cut and what to dress, and said, "Mom, I'm 36 years old, you know. He says, well, when are you going to act like it?" You know, my mother knew, you know. And when I got into this fellowship, it was like I was like 5 years sober and stuff, and we were sitting down and talking, and she said to me, she says, "You know, Greg," because she knew my story, too. She knew. She's my mom. And she says, "I bet you of all the things you lost, you miss your mind the most." You know, she knew. And in spite of all those handicaps, she loved me. She loved me with all her heart. You know, and some people give their parents, well, they enabled me, Whatever I asked for, the money, even when I was out there, my mom believed what I was saying. Or she thought she wanted to believe that I wasn't going to do these things. I was going to do the right thing. So she didn't enable me. She was doing what a mother was supposed to do. Taking care of her kid. You know. So eventually I was able to sit down with my mom and I was to tell her. And I didn't like what... But I did it nicely. I said, "Mom, I don't like when you do these things to me. You know, it makes me feel a certain way." And she said, "Do I really do that?" And I said, "Yeah, and I got the ability to do it too." I said, "Our whole family does." And she says, "Okay, I'll take a look at that." And she did. And she got a little sad. It made me feel a little sad because somebody was pointing out something to her that should have been pointed out a long time ago. But... Just my opinion. But I remember the day I got the call, and this is in the early spring of 95, and I know this because it's my mother's death date and stuff. And at the same time, I had a friend of mine living in the house, Kevin Gotzel, who had HIV, and he could no longer live in his family's house, and we made a little agreement, and he was going to die of AIDS. And it was simultaneously at the same time, because my mom died first, and then Kevin died. But my mom got rushed to the hospital. And she had emphysema, she shouldn't smoke, little lady, and I told you all the nerves, all the stuff that happened to her because of me being homeless and how she worried and the anxiety and everything else. It was taking a toll on her, plus she was up in her 70s. And, but it was speeding the process along. So we got her to the hospital, and something tells you, innate intelligence, you just know. My mom ain't long for this world. So I got to sit down on a bed with her. In the emergency room, I says, "Mom, look, if you gotta go, it's time to go.
It's okay.
She says, yeah, no, but I worry about you. Are you going to be all right? You're so far away from family, because now I'm down in the Freehold area, and you're so far away from everybody. And I said, Mom, and for the first time in my life, I'm going to be all right. And I know I'm going to be all right. I even mentioned Dean's name, because she met Dean a few times. I said, I got Dean. I got Jack, the other buddies and stuff. And I said, I'm going to be all right. I'm going to be all right. You can... And she goes, with that, I guess I can go now. She's a trip, man. She really is. She lasted about 5 days. And I like to say, I'm not afraid of dying, but I've never been face-to-face with death until I see my mom and my other buddy. My mom swore that she was going to go into respiratory, or whatever you call that, resuscitation. She didn't want to have the respirator put on her. Abnormal about it. But as soon as she couldn't grab her breath, and they opened up the lung, stuck the tube in the lung, you know, she didn't want to go. So the fear of death, don't talk to me about it. So that was my little parting of the ways with my mom. And along the way, like I said, I was being a son to her. You know, I was being a son to her. And then the damn doctor took me and my sister in. He says, you smoke? And both of us said, yeah. And she says, here's your role model. Here's your role model. I still smoke to this day. I'm powerless over the next cigarette. Somebody once said to me in this fellowship at Altoona, Grapevine representative. He says, oh, you're one of them, aren't you? I says, yeah. He says, what's your problem? He says, you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. He says, let me get away from this guy. What's your problem? And to this day, I can't get his head, his thought. I still see his face. I remember early on in sobriety, I was trying to quit cigarettes. I remember praying for the obsession to be lifted as I'm lighting a cigarette. I said, this ain't going to work. Ain't going to work. You know. I was just pointing out to Dean, I was just reading today, and I'm going to give you an example, and I want you to please listen to what I say. I said, I want you to go back to your sponsor and say, I don't have to do this. This guy said this. And sometimes just praying for the willingness eliminates a lot of things. The example of people who cannot be seen. Or they're alive, you can't track them down. And I remember, I haven't seen my ex-wife in a long, long time. You know, she left. She didn't leave with disgust like some other speakers will say. My wife left because she had to leave. She even changed divorce lawyers because she didn't want to screw me. She didn't want nothing. She took not even all the clothes. She didn't take any of the furniture. She didn't want none of my insurance. Like I said, she changed lawyers because the other lawyer wanted her to grab everything. She said, no, I just want out. I let her have a car. I let her have a car. Take a car, please. Take a car, please. And I didn't see her for a long time. Didn't know where she was. Matter of fact, when I was visiting my mother up in the hospital, I was going to go visit my mother-in-law. You know, it's time to take care of these things. I went up to the house. It was in the afternoon, and there was no car in the driveway. I was going to go up to the door and leave a note. There was no fear, but the thought came to me, they don't live here no more. The mother-in-law don't live here. And I was right. No, they don't live here no more. So I didn't want to scare some other people saying, oh, I'll be back, here's my number, call me, I was at your door. I didn't want to do that to somebody else, unless, you know. I must be full. So about this time, I asked my sponsor if he could track down some names. I finally knew I'm computer illiterate, and I found out that you can track down people through the computer. So I gave him a list of names and stuff, and you remember the process. We got about 11 names out, and I called every one of them, and I told them what I was doing and what I was trying to find out. And a lot of people wished me good luck. A lot of people said, don't ever call this number again. You know? I let it go. And then going up at retreat, you know how you tell stories at retreat and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, we were talking about ex-wives and stuff. And I still haven't seen my ex-wife. I tried to track her down. I couldn't do it. I made some phone calls. And the guy said to me, I can find your wife. And I said, oh, I shouldn't be talking to this guy either. Why did I start this conversation? The same old idea. So first thought, why did I start this conversation? And I gave him the information, I gave him the names and stuff, and it wasn't that long afterwards, in the mail comes, dan-da-dan-dan. And I knew it was my mother-in-law. It wasn't my wife, so I knew it was my mother-in-law's address. You know, that thing used to reek, boom, boom, mother-in-law, boom. It came out of the page. So now what do I got to do? Excuse me. I've been willing all this time. I got to get the willingness back. I got to get willing again. Because in my head, if I call her, I know what she's going to say. I know what's going to happen. And if she says this, I'm going to have to say this. And I can remember, even before we got married, I flipping this lady off and telling her what the bird meant, verbally, you know. In case she didn't know. And I was really... I wasn't a very good son-in-law at all times. So I got to call this lady. Not only do I got to find my wife, but I got to make amends to her and her daughter, her other daughter. So finally, I work night. I wake up in the afternoon, and boom, I got a call. Thought comes call. This is the time. You got the thought. You're up. There's no excuses. I call, and I can't remember the other daughter's name. And I'm my mouth is dry. And hi, and I can't think of the name. I just said, "This is Greg." Greg Weber, I used to be your brother-in-law, you know. And she's, "Oh, Greg," and the daughter, and she's going on, and I hear the mother in the background, "Who is it? Oh, it's Greg," and I hear, like, hooping and hollering and stuff, and I think, oh. So, but it was all good. It was all good. The mother gets on the phone, "Oh, Greg, how are you? You know, it's years now. It's a long time." And she's, "Oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. Did you get remarried?" And I says, "No, not yet." And she says, "Oh, that's a shame." He says, "Don't you remember who I was?" You know, I'm thinking to myself, she says, "I always thought you would make a good husband for somebody." And then I get, "Do I have the right number?" And she says, no, I always loved you. You know, and again, in spite of ourselves, the people love us. You know, but it's my mind is telling me this is going to happen. I don't want to wring my neck for what I did to a daughter. You know, I was at a point in our marriage where my ex-wife, I got to get that right because I ain't married again. My ex-wife was going to a psychiatrist, suffering from nerves, shaking. She couldn't drive over bridges. She couldn't go into malls. She'd get a vice grip on me that I couldn't lift her fingers off of me. And I think this is my doing. She finally goes to a psychiatrist for some help, a therapist and stuff, and the therapist recommends that I come in together. And I so much at this point wanted to go in together because I wanted to find out what my problem was. I wanted help. But the words out of my mouth says, "This is not my problem. It's your problem. You deal with it. You handle it." And that's when she left me. She took care of it, you know. So now, the mother-in-law said all those things about me, blah, blah, blah. And, "Oh, it was nice. It was nice. It was nice." I says, "Can I have Sharon's number?" She says, "Oh, no, I can't do that." "I won't go that far." "We still love you, but no." "Sharon is married now, and blah, blah, blah." "No, okay. Can you take my number?" And she did. And she says, "Well, Sharon's at work now, so I'll give her the number, and she'll call you when she gets the chance." So I hang up the phone, and it's nice. It's nice. Still a little nervous, but it's nice. You know, lit a cigarette, I finished a cigarette, and the phone rings. I said, "Wow, this stuff works." "And it's a Star Ledger. Would you like to subscribe to the Star Ledger?" The very next day, I woke up about 5 o'clock. Phone rings. And she says, "My ex-wife's name is Sharon." She says, "Greg?" I says, "Yeah, this is Sharon. I got a Sharon cousin named Sharon." I says, "I don't know any other Sharon." I'm thinking, "Who?" "Sharon." He says, "You were talking to my mother?" I says, "I haven't been talking to anybody's mother." And we had a little conversation. You know, and I told her what I was about. And I told her what I wanted to do, and I apologized for, you know, all this stuff. And I said, "Is there anything I could do for you? Anything I could do to make this up?" And she says, "Greg, look, you got a good life. I got a good life. Just keep doing what you're doing." You know, she told me about her son. We always had trouble conceiving. She's got a son now. He's 5 years old. She's very proud of him. A husband. She talked to him. She told him about me. Her husband encouraged her. There was no secrets to call me, see what he wants, you know. It was all good. And she even said, he says, Greg, if I ever see you on the street, I was starting to think, she says, I'll say hello to you. You know? And she told me about the condition that I thought I added to. She says it was a physical thing. After she left me, about a year or so later, the doctors figured out what it was and took care of it. She no longer has those tensions, those nerve things and everything else. And the thing of it was, she thought her being the way she was set me off. So we do not only clear off our side of the streets, we give the other person a chance to clear their mind too. But she had the guilt of her setting me off. You know, so it was really, really nice. It was special. I called her once since then through the mother-in-law. I had to find out where she got divorced. Again, she paid for it. I never set a day. I never set a foot in court. I never even paid the $35 court cost. And I was really a brat. So I called the mother again and found out where I got divorced. We had another little conversation and stuff, and it was nice. And that's all I got to leave it. That's how I leave it. But up until that period of time, the willingness to do these things was all right. I was able to live with it. Some things I can never write. This is what I've been told, and this is what I had to live with. Some things I can never fully write. But through the program, through the acceptance, through the willingness of who I am and what I was doing and why I did those things, and I'm able to live with them. I'm able to live. Every once in a while, I heard somebody speak, like the lady, she broke down and cried, and you know, when things hit her and stuff, and that used to happen to me. There's still the guilt and remorse, and you know, I want to make things better. The forcefulness of this, I want to do this. And today, sometimes they come to me, and the tears that come are gratitude tears. The emotions, because I know I'm doing what I can do best. I'm doing my best. I want to talk about Kevin a little bit, because this gave me some understanding of being there for other people, you know, of getting out of myself. You know, I was homeless for 17 months, and I swore when I got my apartment, nobody I ever know was going to be homeless again. Nobody's going to be homeless. And when I celebrated 2 years, I met Kevin before that. He was a New Yorker, transplanted down in Freehold. And when I heard his voice, I felt at home. I felt companionship right off the bat. When I celebrated 2 years, he celebrated 90 days. When I celebrated 3 years, he celebrated 90 days. He was one of them. I would only see him on Sundays because I later found out he just got out of jail. And he was on parole for some vicious, heinous crimes. And he would never tell us, if you remember. So it was a secret society of Kevin. Only on Sundays I'd see him. I don't know what he did during the week. He told me he worked at a restaurant and had long hours. So I believed him. I believed him. Every Sunday I look forward to meeting this guy. One Sunday he didn't show up. I figured, oh, next Sunday he didn't show up. So finally I got the nerve up to call his mom, who I hadn't met yet. And real quick she says, Kevin's gone and he took the car. I don't know where he is. And she hung up. That was Kevin's M.O. So finally, when I got to meet the parents, and came coming back and forth, I started to meet the parents, the family, and everything. It was a big family. It was great. Irish Catholics, and they just loved me. So finally, I didn't have Kevin. If you want to go out again, don't take the car. The family needs it. So I didn't see Kevin for a while, and I call up. Anna says, Kevin's gone again. But he left the car. He didn't take the car. So we can be useful to other people, you know. Kevin was a trip, man. Kevin was a trip. He wanted to be that urban cowboy. You know, he wanted to be that urban cowboy. So now his illness was getting progression, and we didn't even know. We didn't even know that he had it. He wouldn't tell us. Secret Kevin. He wouldn't tell us. So one day, he came, I was working in an MP, he came in and he told me. We sat down at a bench on break time. And I said, Kevin, why'd you keep this a secret for so long? And he said, I didn't think you would like me. I thought you would walk away from me. So with that, I got up from the bench and I walked away from him just to show him that it's all right. It's all right, Kevin, I love you anyway. His illness got worse with him going back out. Now, this time, he kept going back out. He wasn't taking the car, so Mom would call me, can you pick up Kev? He's in the city. He'll meet you by the Port Authority. I picked up Kevin, and we cleaned him up, and we put him away. Same thing. Notorious. It was ongoing, you know. But finally, one day, out of the blue, I haven't seen him in a while, and I called Anna. Anna's his mom. I said, where's Kevin? Did you hear from him? He says, yeah, he's in the hospital, blah, 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 blah. His illness is really, you know, it's really getting to him. So me and Peggy went up and visited him. Yeah. And he asked me, he says, I can't go back home no more. You know, his mother moved to a smaller place. Yeah, I can't go back home. Can I come and stay with you? I made a vow to myself, nobody was going to be homeless, but yet my mind changed. Kevin got AIDS. My fear. You know, then you read the leopards, the God with the leopards, and everything else. It's a good Samaritan, good thing the guys. And at this point, I'm reading the Sermon on the Mount. I'm reading the message and what I should be reading. Every time I read Sermon on the Mount, I read this book. And every time I read this book, I read Sermon on the Mount. And I want to be an instrument of God. So I says, Kevin, just give me a day. Let me get all right with this. Let me see what I got to do. So at the time, I was working at Discovery House. And I went to the AIDS coordinator, and I found out what I had to do to protect him, not for him to protect me, because he was more vulnerable than I was. And I'm not the cleanest guy in the world, and I had to scrub my bathtub, I had to disinfect the toilets and then the sinks and all the cups just for his protection. It wasn't for me. And now, for the first time in my life, I'm getting out of myself. And I remember Dean, too, saying, for the first time in your life, you're not talking about yourself, you're caring about somebody else. Me and Kevin made a little agreement. We had to. I says, when you can't take care of yourself no more and I can't help you, you're going to have to go. I don't know what we're going to do, but we'll worry about that when the time comes. I don't know how long he lived with me. He lived with me for a while. I mean, a little while. One night I happened to be off. Thank God I was off. 4 o'clock in the morning, I hear him moaning and screaming, and Kevin's in pain, and his ear is bleeding, and he's got a cancerous growth in his mouth, and he's in pain. Rushed him to the hospital, and they put him there for a while, and he came out, and I says, Kevin, this is the time. Both of us crying like babies, because we knew. This is the time you got to go. He went back to Mom's. It was his Christmas, a 94 going into 95. And by law, see, this is something we found out. By law, I just blew it. Nursing homes have to take AIDS patients. We didn't know that. We found out, and we got him in a nursing home. And we used to pick him up, drag him to meetings, remember? We got his butt out in the wheelchair, and we dragged him to meetings, and I would feed him, I'd buy him ice pops, and he was always complaining about the old biddies in the place because they'd always steal his ice pops and stuff. But it was fun. I got to get out of myself. Since I worked at nights, I was there most of the days with him and stuff, and we dragged him in and out of meetings, and then it got to the point where he couldn't take meetings anymore. Now, I did a fourth step with this guy. You know, he's reading Sermon on the Mount. The doctor, the minister, who's coming to visit him, he would flash the book in front of him. He says, you ever read this book? Sermon on the Mount. You ever read this book? The guy said, no. He said, I really think you should read this book. He's telling the minister, I really think you should read this book. The minister read the book. And at his eulogy, Kevin's eulogy, he's saying, Kevin turned me on to this book, blah, blah, blah. I says, yeah, and that's my book, and I want it back. I went out and bought myself another one. But the one thing I didn't like about this whole thing, listen to me, I did not agree with was the family's wishes. They called me and I said, this is the night Kevin's dying. I don't know if they arranged it or the doctor told them, because he was on a morphine drip 24 hours a day. And he said, this is the night Kevin's going. And even Kevin said to us, he says, what are you all doing here? I want to say, Kevin, this is your last night. I wanted to tell him so he could do whatever he had to do. And they took me outside and they wouldn't let me say anything. I'm all right with it now. There's nothing I could do about it. That was their wishes. I abided by other people's wishes instead of me butting my mouth in there. And then, Kevin, this is your night. You know, giving him permission, just like I did my mom, and I blamed that in his fellowship. You know, give him permission. It's okay to go. You gotta go. You gotta go. Don't struggle. Don't fight it. And if you don't go, you don't go. But don't fight it. '95. Mom died. Kevin died. I went to the International Convention in San Diego. And I've been saving a long time for that. My mom bought me suitcases for Christmas to pack me off, so I look good. I have a nice suitcase and stuff. And I get on the field, Jack Murphy Stadium, and I get in the batter's box. This is a baseball field. I get in the batter's box. I'm looking around the dugout, and I'm swinging, and I'm imagining all stuff as I'm a kid. And I said to myself, I can't wait to get back home and tell Mom. She's been gone 3 months. It didn't hit me to that point. My mom is gone. My mom is gone. And then the old thoughts, did I do good by her? The old thoughts came up, but I had to get all right again. And I'm walking around the stadium, and I said, I got to talk to somebody. And I'm thinking, my sick mind says, there's a pretty woman, there's another woman. I want to talk to you about my mom, what I mean? So I just lined myself up, and I'm looking at the stage. It's pretty empty, the stadium. I'm looking at the stage. I'm centering myself. And the guy's head pops up. And tears are rolling out of my face and stuff. And what's going on? And I just told him the experience I just had. And he says, my parents are from Jersey. Tell him I have. Completely took my mind off the whole thing. I got it right with the whole situation. I finally accepted the death. My mom is gone. I did the best I could and everything else. And everything was good. So when I got back, I told her what I did in San Diego. I probably talked to my mom probably more now than I ever did in my life. My mom was a character. My family's a character. The old people, my wife, my ex-wife, my friends. I got one friend who I wanted to make amends. Again, Eddie Sarrell. Went to Little League with him. Went to high school with him. He was my best man at my wedding. The guy almost took the baseball back to him. At the same time I'm visiting my mother, I run into his brother. His brother's having their first child. Greg, wow, you look great. What are you doing? Reminiscing, getting back, exchanging phone number. I said, give me Eddie's number. No, I can't give it. Again, I can't give you Eddie's number. He says, well, let me have yours. And I gave him mine and stuff. And I called him for Christmas. And I even called him. I said, what'd you get? What'd you have? Baby, congratulations and everything else. How's Eddie doing? Tell him, here's my number. If you don't want to give me ask him to call me. Please, ask him to call me. The more I called that house, Christmas time, Jimmy wouldn't even get on the phone. He had somebody tell me he's playing with the nephews now. He's busy now. I'll call you back. I never got to talk to Eddie. 2000, we went to my 30th class high school reunion. I figured he'd be there. I knew he wouldn't be there. He wasn't there. I have his address now. That's as far as it went. I have his address. But my mind is telling me if he don't want to see me, I'm not going to force the issue. He knows where I'm at. What do I do? I'm all right with it. I'm all right with it. What can I do? I can force the issue. I ain't all right with it. Let's put it that way. Because it still flips in my head. You know what I'm saying. Strange mental blank spots. Again, pray for the willingness. Wherever. And to all. There's some other little penny things, and I'll end with this. One of the first things, we lose fear of our creditors. We must. My mother gave me up when I was in the institution to my creditor. I made some arrangements with him. I told him where I was, and I told him what I would do when I got out. Made arrangements. I almost had her name off the top of my head. She would send me self-stamped envelopes. This lady really cared. And I remember one time, early in the fellowship, I didn't have nobody to call during the afternoon. The inhibitions wouldn't. So I called her. You don't use the phone, so I used that. She says, how you doing? I says, I'm okay. How you doing? I was thinking, blah, blah, blah. And then later on, it was nothing. And later on, she called me back. She says, the institution you was in, Discovery, what's the name of Discovery House? And she had a father's son needed help, and she was calling me, and this lady was sweet. So along the line, it was only like $3,200, my whole thing, $50 a month. But to me, that was a lot of money, considering my financial situation. And I'm down to about $1,200. I send a check in. I get the check back. I says, we have no record of your account or any number. And this is after a couple of years. It's still sent in the same place, self-stamped envelope, came back. So I call these people up. And I says, is Mrs. there? She says, no, she no longer works for us. I says, well, you don't understand. I just got this back. I want to pay this thing. I have to pay this thing off. You know, the amends, I got to make this, otherwise I'll drink. I'm arguing. I got to pay this. Don't you understand? She says, sir, we have no record of your account. We never had a record of your account. There's no name, no listing, no nothing. So I forced the issue, and I sent the check the next month. And then my mind played with me. Now, maybe she erased the accounts. I stopped sending money just to see what would happen. I never heard from these people again. I would like to believe Mrs. Long took care of this for me. I'd like to believe that. It doesn't show up on my credit report. You give, you get. You try to do the right thing happens. I was a firm believer when I came in here, what you put out, you know, you get back in return. You put out crap, you get crap back. You try to do the right thing comes back to you. I fully believe that today. I really thank you for listening. I really do. And it's done me a world of good. And I'm glad you're here because I know a lot of you have busy schedules. A lot of it was graduation night. And I appreciate you coming out. And hopefully I'll see you all next week. Until then, God bless you. Thank you.